fasting. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Ammar in the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
This Israeli genocidal war is setting records. In addition to dropping one of the largest volumes of bombs and munitions on the civilian population, which has been compared to the nuclear bomb that the U.S. dropped in Hiroshima, the UN has said that the number of children killed during the first 4 months of the war has topped all those killed in 4 years of wars across the globe. In this edition of the program, we will look at how the U.S. and its allies are looking to give off the impression of doing a good deed with airdropping food or delivering aid to Gaza, while rifts between the U.S. President Joe Biden and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are widening over the aggression overall. Let me introduce our guests for this edition of the program. Sudnimmer is a professor of political science at Birzeit University who joins us from Ramallah. Also joining us is Sam Parker, political activist who ran against Mitt Romney for the U.S. Senate, joining us from Salt Lake City, Utah. Welcome to you both. Sudnimmer, first over to you. This is a very shocking and grim stat. Coming from Philippe Lazzarini, I'm sure you heard of him, the Commissioner General of UNRWA, War on Children. He said a war on their childhood and their future. The number of children reported killed in just over 4 months is higher than the number of children killed in 4 years of wars around the world combined. What's your impression of what he has said?
We know that what was going on in Gaza, this aggression against Gaza, it's a genocide. It's not even a war like any other war, because the Israelis, they don't have any intelligence about what's going on in Gaza underground. And since they lack of information, what they are doing is just these bombardments. And definitely, when you are talking about 2.2 million people living in a very small area, not more than 365 square kilometers, then definitely there will be a very high casualty among the civilians. And since Palestinians in general, whether in Gaza or in the West Bank and in Jerusalem, 52% of our population are under 18 years old. So we are talking about 52% of our population are children. So wherever you hit, definitely half of the casualties will be children, and definitely the others will be also women. So women and children so far are more than 70% of the casualties in this aggression or genocide. So because of that, definitely the number of children, we are talking about more than 12,000 so far of children were killed because of these bombardments. That's not to mention those who were severely injured and those who became handicapped because of limbs being cut off or hands, right, or legs or these kind of things, in addition to the last numbers of children who are dying because of hunger.
Taking a look at the stat that you just heard, I'm wondering what you think about this, Sam Parker, when there are two things that stand out here. Just as recent as a few weeks ago, the U.S. was reported to send weapons to Israel amid this invasion threat in the Rafah area. And this planned delivery of bombs and other munitions comes also on the heels of another report that came out by the Washington Post. If you heard about those, contracts that were hidden, not revealed, where, again, bombs and munitions were sent, which has contributed to this number of children that have been killed in the Gaza Strip. What do you think about the U.S. administration and the assistance that they've given to the Israeli regime militarily?
Yeah, that's a good question. I appreciate you having me on. But absolutely, it's very duplicitous, and obviously it's a lot of optics, and it's a PR stunt, essentially. I have a picture saved on my computer that I saw a few days ago that was circulating online of the parachute airdrop of the food with bombs blowing up buildings in the background in Gaza. In the same picture, U.S. Food pallets drifting down out of the sky and bombs falling and blowing up buildings and people. So the United States is engaged in doing both things and playing both sides, but really they're just playing one side. They're playing the Israel side because they've been sending all kinds of bombs and munitions over to Israel to drop on Gaza and to use in this conflict. It's not a war, right? This is not a war. People are calling it a war, but it's not a war because Gaza doesn't have armed forces, so to speak. It doesn't have tanks and planes and attack helicopters and armored personnel carriers and infantry and Marines and all these things. It's not a conventional war. It's mostly just 2.2 million civilians just getting bombed from here to there and everywhere by the most modern weaponry known to mankind. And the United States has been covertly sending this without the knowledge of Congress, circumventing Congress without congressional approval. And now to sort of save face, to curry favor with their voter base, and to not look so bad on the international stage, they're doing these stunts like dropping a couple truckloads worth of food that really don't amount to much. The first airdrop only had 38,000 meals, which if you think about it, 38,000 meals, how does that begin to feed a population of 2.2 million people who are literally now starving to death? The latest figures I've heard are about 600,000 Gazans are at catastrophic levels of starvation right now. And so a couple truckloads of aid delivered, that's just a PR stunt, especially when, as you pointed out, it's being done at the same time that we're sending just truckloads of bombs and munitions, and many of them in secret. So it's duplicitous. It's just a PR stunt. And I think it signals an unseriousness from the Biden administration.
Senator Nimmerbauer, just talked about this food drops that have occurred, how minimal they are. It's quite mind-boggling when you think about what he said, where you have the food drops and you have bombs in the background that are blowing up buildings that have civilians inside of it. I mean, one has to scratch their head and say, what can we do? What can be done? There's not a phone call that you can make because obviously this genocide continues. But then you have the other side, another ally as a whole, the EU, who although has critiqued Israel, they have come out with the maritime food corridor. I don't know, have you seen that barge that's carrying what is said to be 200 tons of aid? That doesn't look like it even holds thousands of Palestinians. Why are they doing this when such minimal amounts of food going to the Strip in the first place, and B, when you have the crossings that have trucks waiting there to go inside the Strip? What's the deal there?
Yes, I do agree with your guest from Utah that it is a BR thing, because we know that in Gaza we have five crossings for goods between Israel and the Gaza Strip. We are talking about Kisufim, Sofa, and Karni, apart from Rafah crossing with Egypt, and apart from Erez, which is also for personnel. But for goods, there are four other crossings between Israel and Gaza Strip. So if the Americans and other Arab countries and some European countries can drop and have the agreement of Israel to drop some of the goods by air, I think they should, force them or agree with them to open the crossings and to get in all the goods normally, as it used to be before the 7th of October. Before the 7th of October, we were talking about 500 trucks or shipments coming to Gaza every day. Now we are talking about only 100 and only through Rafah. So it's absolutely absurd. So it's a BR thing. It's not nothing more than that. And then the American came with this brilliant idea about, making a kind of a port into Gaza, and they ordered the military to do it. It needs something like 3 months to be established, 3 months. What will happen to the people who are starving now in 3 months' time? This is, I think also, it is because the Israeli, they don't want the UNRWA to be involved. And this is part of the war on the UNRWA. So now they are talking about alternative organizations to deliver the aid to the Palestinians. And they want to, you know, ignore the UNRWA because from their point of view, the UNRWA is helping the Palestinian resistance, which is not true at all. And it's we know the aim by the Israeli, sure, why they are targeting the UNRWA, because it is the organization that is keeping the right for the Palestinians to return to their land, and that's why they have this war against it. And the Americans are involved in that. When they just, you know, cut all the aid to the UNRWA just lately, and during Trump era also, right, they did that before.
Okay.
It's targeting the UNRWA.
Yeah, we could talk about the logistics and how ridiculous it sounds, thinking that this is going to work better than the land routes, which UN has said that, Sam Parker, that land routes are obviously the way to go. But we got to move on to another topic of this U.S. military assessment that came out, this intel report, just very recent. And I'm going to combine two issues into one. One, it said Hamas, on Hamas, Israel probably will face lingered armed resistance from Hamas for years to come. And then you have, on another note, how Israeli regime forces suffering defeat on the battlefield. There's plans to lift military service exemption of these ultra-Orthodox Jews. Do you think that they are losing that on the battlefield? And combined with this report, that is one thing they want to do, is to keep feeding the regime forces side of things in order to continue the genocide?
Well, it certainly looks that way. And I saw the protests from these Orthodox Jews in Israel that erupted last week, where they were blocking highways for several hours at a time. And you had conflict, physical conflict going on between Israeli police officers and the Orthodox protesters. And this is an idea that's been building for the last month or two inside of Israel. I think Itamar Ben-Gvir has been pushing for this. He hasn't wanted to make it a force of law yet, but they've absolutely been pushing this idea of drafting these people into the service who have traditionally been exempted. So that does signal that they are short on manpower, that they do want to prolong this conflict. And I think, you know, going back to the last topic of this aid package that's coming from Europe through the maritime corridor, that's, I guess, going to be delivered onto this temporary pier that the United States is constructing. It's going to take 2 months to build that pier, minimum. And so that signals right there, that's a soft signal that this assault on Gaza is going to last at least for another couple months, even though you have Benjamin Netanyahu saying maybe 4, maybe 6 weeks, but the United States is counting on at least 2 months. So
do you think that's by design? I'm sorry to jump in. Do you think they've designed it that way in order to have that 2 months or 3 months maybe for Israel to be able to do its military maneuvers on the ground?
Absolutely. I think they're giving cover to Israel. There's no question about it. Look, Benny Gantz, one of, you know, the leader of the opposition party, the National Unity Party, who is thought of as one of the major rivals to Benjamin Netanyahu, made a visit to Washington, D.C. last week, basically with the coordination of the Biden administration to help the Biden administration politically to take heat off of them, but also to signal that they still support Israel, but take heat off of their relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu and put forward a positive, you know, we're just against terrorism in general, and we support Israel. So I think there are a lot of political moves being made. This is a PR stunt. And some have even suggested that this pier will become a permanent pier that Israel will use once they completely take over Gaza once and for all. So I do think that this is a stunt because, as you said, as has been said by the other guest, there's 5 crossings into Gaza already with food trucks ready to go. It doesn't make any sense.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, this U.S. military intel report said needs a little bit more opening up. And one of the things it has said is the fact that there's distrust on Netanyahu by the masses, Israeli masses, and that the protests are going to swell up even after the genocidal war ends, and they're going to demand Netanyahu's resignation, and that may actually force him to leave office. Do you believe that Netanyahu is on his last legs?
Okay, I think that, yes, Netanyahu is facing really a big problem now inside Israel. Last week there was a poll conducted in Israel, and most of the population in Israel, for 53% of those who were conducted in the poll, they said that we believe now that Netanyahu is making the war now going on and on for his own personal reasons, not for the sake of Israel. Otherwise, he should agree to the deal to release the prisoners captive by the Palestinian resistance, but he's doing that for his own personal issues, knowing that he's going after that to the, to face the court and maybe also prison, but definitely not being a prime minister anymore after Gantz being even welcomed in America, and that was really make Netanyahu very, very angry with that, because now the Americans are dealing with Gantz as the next prime minister in Israel. Now, in Israel itself, there are now, and it's unprecedented, it's for the very first time ever in a war in Israel that you see this fragmentation in the Israeli society. A part of that is the families of the captive prisoners in Gaza. On the other hand, you have people of, especially the mothers and families of the soldiers killed in Gaza, and the numbers are really very high, though the Israelis are not announcing it quite right. And they are demanding that we don't want our children to be killed now in Gaza anymore. Mm-hmm. And also you have another pressure coming from those who were removed from north of Palestine because of Hezbollah in Lebanon, and those who removed from the south of Palestine because of the aggression on Gaza. So sure. Now you are talking about lots of problems that Netanyahu is facing, and all these are elements of pressure on Netanyahu. So yeah, I believe that he had to finish this job by the end of the day, because there is lots of pressure coming from other countries and from the Americans. The problem with Netanyahu, my last sentence, the problem with Netanyahu, if he go to a ceasefire, he's admitting the defeat of Israel for the second time in this aggression.
Interesting point you make there. Sam Parker, the rift between Bibi and Biden. I mean, is it real? Is it deep? Is it as bad as these red lines for Rafah, where Biden has put it out there, taken it back, but put it out there again? That they're on a collision course. I mean, even there's this, again, intel report that's saying a senior Israeli official on the condition of anonymity revealing that the U.S. is actually seeking to oust the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Are we looking at what is being reported to be real when it comes to the two?
There may be a rift between the administration and Netanyahu, but I don't think that there's a fundamental rift between the U.S. administration and Israel itself and the policy and its current policies and its current warmongering. I don't think there's a rift there. I don't think that the United States is going to stand in the way of what Israel wants to do. Now, Netanyahu has become is starting to become more of a political liability. Look, in Israel, like the other guest just said, he's deeply unpopular. He was already unpopular before October 7th. There were massive protests out in the streets of Jerusalem. Some say that Israel was even on the brink of civil war. And since then, they blame Netanyahu for the debacle of October 7th. They blame him for the death of these hostages. They're furious with him that he won't negotiate to bring the hostages home. And that they know that Israel has killed, likely killed, some of their own hostages. So he's even more unpopular than he was before, and he was deeply unpopular before. It's just that, you know, in the middle of a war, it's hard to make, you know, a change like that. So I don't think that there is a red line. I think that politically this is hurting the Joe Biden administration, and it's hurting his reelection campaign. And I think that any rhetoric that seeks to diminish Benjamin Netanyahu or to, you know, to put forth any idea of a red line is really to serve his base that is mad at him for supporting a genocide. And so I think it's going toward his reelection campaign. I don't think it shifts a fundamental change. I don't think it signals a fundamental shift in U.S. policy towards helping Israel do what it wants to do. Look, this, we just said this pier, it's going to take 2 months. That gives Israel cover it needs to the cover it needs for at least the next couple or 3 months. So sure. I think it's mostly rhetoric and to take heat off him for his reelection campaign.
Well, Saad Nimr, the U.S. President Joe Biden was very sure and confident that there would be a ceasefire. He even announced the day of the week, Monday, a few days prior to Ramadan. We saw that that didn't happen. Now, one of the reasons was the insistence by Hamas to have a permanent ceasefire. It did not want a temporary one. What's wrong with that? Why should that have been one of the thorny issues that some are saying that led to this ceasefire not to happen?
Yeah, well, you know, let's put it just, you know, bluntly like this. What they wanted Hamas to deliver all the prisoners, to give them back, and which is the only card in their hands, Hamas, and then they will continue the war. So what's the purpose then? Definitely Hamas is not going to give all these 134 prisoners that they have for only a ceasefire, and when they deliver them, the Israeli will continue and resume the killing and the war against Gaza. So definitely they will insist on a ceasefire. And there is a huge understanding anyway among all those who are involved in this negotiation with that, and they believe that there should be a ceasefire. The problem here is the Netanyahu himself. Now, for the Americans, yes, I do agree with Sam. When we are talking about the deep state in the United States, definitely they are going to back up Israel and always will support Israel. But sometimes you have between the administration and the government in Israel some problems. And we saw that also during Obama. So it might happen like that. But it is not that deep rift in the relationship, which would make Biden force Israel to do something they don't want to do. Mm-hmm. We know that Biden can, you know, in half an hour order Israel to stop the war, and they will stop it. Otherwise, we won't give you anything. So if they want to do it, they can do it. But they are involved, and they are still going on with Israel in this war. So this pressure by Biden to achieve a kind of a ceasefire before Ramadan, okay, it failed. And who failed it was Netanyahu, because he insisted, and he withdrew his delegation from Egypt in the last moment, and he don't want to continue negotiations.
Sure.
And he's blaming Hamas. So, yeah, we think it's not that much of negotiations anyway, since they are sticking to their opinion.
1 minute. We keep hearing about how the U.S. can pick up the phone, Sam Parker, and tell the war, the onslaught to stop. We hear that a lot. But we don't hear the fact that the U.S., with all the military assistance it's given, has not been able to help Israel win the onslaught. Why do you think that is? Less than a minute, please.
Well, I think the goal hasn't been to quote-unquote win, because I think Israel wants that land and it wants to move the people off the land. It also wants to have exact retribution and revenge for what happened on October 7th. And so they're starving these people. They're collectively punishing them. They're systematically destroying all civilizational infrastructure, hospitals, schools, mosques, churches, apartments, homes, everything, roads. There's nothing left in many parts of Gaza. So they're not fighting a war. They're not fighting a conventional war where we're trying to beat the enemy and take out its enemy force, so much as that they're trying to clear out the land, ethnically cleanse them, and take it over. That's been their goal. And so I think while they project the idea of winning.
Thank you very much, Sam Parker, political activist, ran against Mitt Romney for the U.S. Senate, Salt Lake City, Utah. Saad Nimr, a pleasure. Professor of Political Science, Brzezet University from Ramallah. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikko Vetawe and the team, is goodbye.
The This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, what are we being invited towards in the holy month of Ramadan? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So dear friends, we are talking about what are we being invited to in the holy month of Ramadan. You know, what we're doing here on A to Z and trying to understand this Islamic lifestyle is to really understand the essence of, you know, some of the practices that we do, and especially the holy month of Ramadan, because of the great importance that Allah has given to the holy month of Ramadan. Of course, we find beautiful verses in the Holy Quran regarding the holy month of Ramadan, and we find many beautiful traditions from the Ahlul Bayt, peace and blessings upon them all, and the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, when it comes to the holy month of Ramadan and its beauties and its speciality and its priority, you know. But then, you know, eventually we come to this point and we ask, well, you know, what is it that we're being invited to in the holy month of Ramadan? We find that, you know, there is so much importance given to this holy month, you know, that this month is a divine feast. It is a divine banquet whose host is the Supreme Lord and the Almighty God. So what exactly is it that we're being invited to? Well, there are many various different things that we are being invited to, and they are related in the traditions of the infallibles, alayhim as-salam. But there's two things which we are specifically being invited to. One of those is forgiveness, and of course the other is blessings. Forgiveness and blessings. These are two of the main things that we have been invited to in the holy month of Ramadan.
Ramadan al-mustabin jaa bin nur al-mubin. Ramadan, Ramadan, Ramadan al-qanitin.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about what we are being invited to in the holy month of Ramadan. We talked a little bit about how, you know, the importance of the holy month of Ramadan. We talked about how the traditions from the Immaculate and Infallibles, alayhim as-salam, help us to kind of realize how very, very important is the holy month of Ramadan. And then we said, well, why are we, you know, being told the importance and the priority of this holy month, the holy month of Ramadan? And we started to kind of, you know, delve into this idea that what is it that we are being invited towards in this holy month? And it is because we're being invited towards certain things that the importance of the holy month becomes known to us just a little bit. So we brought up two things. One was forgiveness, and the second one was blessings. Now, of course, you know, these are also aspects that are integral to our Islamic lifestyle, right? Asking Allah for forgiveness. And blessings really is something that Allah gives us when we decide to live a Islamic lifestyle. But when it comes to the holy month of Ramadan, we find that forgiveness is one of the things which Allah the Almighty is inviting towards. And of course, you know, we can be very honest with ourselves. Every single one of us can use a little bit of forgiveness. And if we want to be really honest with ourselves, every single one of us can use a lot of forgiveness. And to be honest with you, the more forgiveness that we can attain, the better it is for us, both in this world and the hereafter. The holy month of Ramadan is an excellent opportunity for us to be able to attain that forgiveness and really keep that forgiveness with us. 30 days in which we ask Allah for forgiveness, of course,
after 30 days, this should become a habit. It should become a part of us. It should become, you know, like our flesh and blood, that asking for forgiveness from the Almighty Allah. But asking is one side. The beauty about the holy month of Ramadan is that Allah says, I will give you forgiveness and I will give you blessings. And so this kind of starts to show us a glimmer of the importance of the holy month of Ramadan. And this, dear friends, is what we are being invited towards, blessings and forgiveness.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On the first day of the holy month of Ramadan in Nigeria, the Islamic movement held a rally through the streets of the capital, Abuja, in a peaceful protest against the massacre of innocent civilians in Gaza. The protest march took the demonstrators to the gate of the United States Embassy, where they sat down and submitted a letter of protest condemning the Israeli genocide in Gaza and U.S. involvement in the killing of innocent Palestinians.
America is one of the major party in this killing of innocent female and children in Gaza. Since October 7th to date, they have killed 31,000, more than 31,000 innocent people, majorly female and children in Gaza.
The demonstrators blame the United States and British governments for using their influence to block a UN resolution calling for a ceasefire. They said every decent government has condemned the Israeli terror attacks on the Palestinians, but the US government has continued to support the mass murder of innocent Palestinians.
They are killing female and children. They are imposing starvation on innocent female and children. Babies have been seen under rubble, crying inside blood. we see a lot of fathers carrying a lifeless body of their children killed by Israelis. Anybody that has concern for humanity should come out today on the street and show his solidarity with Palestinians.
The demonstrators burned the U.S. and Israeli flags as they slammed Tel Aviv's regime impunity and the silence of the international community. Many Muslims in Nigeria believe that Israel's continuous killing of Palestinians in Gaza on the eve of the holy month of Ramadan is a clear proof of the regime's disrespect for Islamic sanctities. The protesters here are urging world leaders to pressure Israel to end the massacre in Gaza. Tanjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
Britons treat their National Health Service, better known as the NHS, with an almost religious reverence.
We grow up using the NHS from the cradle to the grave, free at the point of use, and that has tremendous significance for our lives.
But today, this eternal source of national pride is under increased scrutiny, with new figures showing more than 120,000 people died last year in England alone from delays in life-saving treatment. The NHS is a state-funded healthcare system founded in 1948. Back then, it cost around $20 billion in today's money to run. Last year, the government spent more than $181 billion. Despite that, more than 7 million people are now on the waiting list in England alone. That's nearly 12% of the population having to wait at least 52 weeks for a health consultation.
Our politicians aren't really serving the public interest. They are serving a neoliberal agenda, which is to transfer the country's natural assets and wealth to overseas corporations like United Health of America and other big multinationals.
The government has promised to cut the long queues, but has made little progress. The situation is no better in the rest of the kingdom. In Scotland and Northern Ireland, 1 in 80 people, and in Wales, 1 in 20 are having to wait more than a year for treatment. There's also the energy costs and inflation that has reduced the value of the NHS budget, meaning it now has to do more with significantly less. Add to the mix a shortage of staff, which means more pressure on exhausted employees.
We've had more than a decade of defunding since the financial crash. This has led to a real terms wage cut for staff. The whole population, the health needs have gone up. We have trouble keeping hold of staff, and we've also lost significant capacity with the NHS through privatisation. So we don't have enough beds, we don't have enough staff, and the staff we do have are being treated appallingly.
The health service is also coping with an aging population. A large number of people now live with chronic conditions like heart disease and diabetes. The COVID-19 pandemic severely tested the NHS, with its aftermath still posing serious challenges. Health officials and experts warn for the UK's National Health Service to survive, the next government should declare it a national emergency. Saipur is at London.
India says it will enact the Citizenship Amendment Act that provides fast-track naturalization for multiple religious groups who fled to India from Afghanistan, Bangladesh and Pakistan before 2014. The law, however, excludes Muslims from those countries. Back in 2019, law's approval sparked deadly protests across the country and was halted since. The Muslim minority in India fears the government is using this law and other similar laws to widen crackdown on them.
India introduced this bill in 2016 with the aim of granting citizenship to what it calls a persecuted section of refugees. However, the bill has become one of the most controversial issues across the country, since it excludes Muslims from availing citizenship. Critics accuse the ruling BJP of targeting a particular community on the basis of faith, which experts call unconstitutional.
Commentators also question the exclusion of persecuted religious minorities from other regions such as Tibet, Sri Lanka and Myanmar. India's Interior Ministry has said in a statement, those eligible can now apply online for Indian citizenship. The issue has been one of the key pledges of Indian Prime Minister since assuming office in 2014. The new legislation makes changes to more than six decades old Indian citizenship law.
It's unfortunate for us that we are not part of this new law, despite the fact we have faced worse persecution any community has faced so far. We have still hope one day India will accept us on the ground of humanity.
Opposition political parties have accused the ruling party of influencing the elections, saying the move is to polarize the voters, considering its timing. More than 200 petitions challenging the law are still pending before the court of law.
We thank India they provide us shelter. It's an act of kindness, but we urge this country not to abandon us, knowing the fact we have seen deadly violence and persecution.
India, home to roughly 200 million Muslims, have recently seen targeted attacks and vicious hate campaigns. Critics accuse the ruling party of mixing religion with politics, resonating with India's majority. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Russia Navy Warship and China Navy Warship. This is Iranian Navy Warship 235, Italian Channel 16. Do you read me? Over.
The Maritime Security Belt 2024 has officially kicked off with Russian and Chinese vessels entering Iran's territorial waters south of the country on Tuesday. The naval and airborne units of Iran's army and the IRGC, along with their Chinese and Russian counterparts, will participate in various operations during this exercise. Naval delegations from Azerbaijan, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Oman and South Africa have also taken part as observer states. At the first stage of the drill, the naval officers of the three countries as well as the observer states reviewed different phases of the exercise on maps and held tactical briefings. Later, the naval commanders of Iran, Russia and China held a joint presser. The Iranian Navy's deputy commander said the main aim of the joint exercise is to help safeguard security in the northern part of the Indian Ocean.
Upholding peace and security in the north of Indian Ocean and having a specialized cooperation in combating piracy and terrorism in our region are among the main goals of this exercise. We are constantly working to improve this cooperation.
Meanwhile, Chinese and Russian Navy commanders said the joint exercise further demonstrates the preparedness of the participating countries to maintain security while also deepening their practical cooperation. 2024 is the fifth consecutive year that the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy is hosting countries participating in the Maritime Security Belt drills in the northern Indian Ocean region.
This year's naval drills have kicked off under the motto Together for Peace and Security, with participating countries highlighting the importance of jointly safeguarding regional security. Mahdiab Bosyan, Konarak.
This is not the first time Palestinian people are spending Ramadan under Israeli aggression. In 2014, the Israeli regime also waged a destructive war on Gaza during the holy month. However, the current genocidal war is unprecedented in terms of its colossal casualties. Many Palestinians have become orphans and widows and lost their children. The memory of their loved ones will stay with them in Ramadan.
The life here is so difficult. The holy month of Ramadan is around the corner and we are still displaced from our homes and our families are torn apart. We have nothing to eat for iftar. I'm originally from Gaza. I've lost 37 members of my family. They were so close to my heart. Every time I remember them, my gut is wrenched and I become so sad and furious.
With markets destroyed and goods scarce, Gazans don't know where their iftar meals will come from, which means more suffering and agony. The vast majority of the people live in small tents amid the starvation that has already claimed the lives of several Palestinian children.
The situation in Gaza is very difficult. There is no food. The people are struggling to find anything to eat with flour scarce. Here in the south, they queue in long lines for food. Even those who attempt to get anything from the aid trucks are putting their lives at risk as Israeli soldiers open fire on them. I don't know what we're going to do in Ramadan.
Palestinians' catastrophe doesn't stop with the loss of their relatives. It is deepened by the full-scale destruction that has become palpable in every corner of Gaza, including mosques, which means they won't be able to say their prayers and worships as usual. Even if their mosques hadn't been destroyed, it would still be impossible for them to perform their prayers under the incessant Israeli bombardments.
The humanitarian conditions are completely disastrous. The people were displaced from several parts of Gaza, including the northern and central areas of the Strip. It is literally catastrophic. There is no source of income or food, and the people are completely relying on the small amounts of donation provided by a limited numbers of charity institutions. In addition to that, mosques have been completely destroyed by Israeli warplanes, and we will never be able to pray in them.
While some aid has been trickling into Gaza, it's minuscule compared to the needs of the Palestinians. With Ramadan arriving, more assistance cannot come soon enough for them.
As the whole Muslim nation welcomes Ramadan, Palestinians are wondering why they have been abandoned by many Muslim leaders to face the Israeli campaign of death and starvation. To Abu Musabbih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
The Iranian National Oil and Gas Company says that this is the most strategic project in the history of Iran's oil and gas industry and its long-sought empowerment of domestic entities. Under this project, 90 trillion cubic feet of gas and 2 billion barrels of gas condensates will be available for use. Top Iranian companies Petropars, Oil Industries Engineering and Construction, Khatam al-Anbiya Construction Headquarters, Mapna Group, and a consulting company are the contractors of the mega project.
In the subject matter of the development and increase of capacities of the gas and oil refineries, we witnessed the second phase of Abadan refinery with the capacity of 210,000 barrels, which helped the production and supply of gas in the country. In the 14th phase of the South Pars refineries, 50 million cubic feet of gas is produced per day, which again adds to the capacity of gas production in the country.
The massive project has created an opportunity to kickstart economic prosperity and employment in the face of unilateral Western sanctions. This has also allowed Iranian producers and companies to engage greatly in the economic growth and industrial development of the country and neutralize the sanctions.
Today, all Iranian people should witness the fact that the surrounding nations trust the Iranian National Oil Company and the relative competent companies and contractors and do rely on them, because they know well that the South Pass was built by Iranian companies, and the day that they thought that it was impossible to do so without the help and presence of foreigners, that exact day was the day that South Pass became what it is today.
While sanctions have forced the governing bodies to change their attitude towards domestic companies and entrust them with tasks, it should be noted that Iranian producers are not perennial supporters of sanctions. Rather, they would like to interact and acquire world-class technologies from foreign companies to empower themselves.
With contracts for developing oil and gas fields signed and projects for boosting pressure in South Pars gas field being started, Iran is experiencing yet another success in the mega gas project to exploit the immense gas field. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Chants echoed through the streets of the Pakistani capital Islamabad as thousands of demonstrators gathered to condemn the United States and Israel.
Ceasefire now!
The protest, organized by Pakistan's largest religio-political party, Jamaat-e-Islami, saw passionate crowds marching through the streets, expressing solidarity with the Palestinian cause and denouncing Israel's actions, which take place with the support of the U.S.
Of course, there should be a ceasefire long ago, but even now we are pressing for it, and you have seen how irresponsible and insensitive Biden has been responding. He was just having ice cream and talking about ceasefire as if it was a very casual affair. And on the other hand, the way children are dying, women are dying from morning till night, and especially there are a lot of prisoners which are taken by Israel. And there are large number of women and children who have been taken as prisoners, and their condition is pathetic.
The acts of solidarity in Pakistan reflect widespread outrage and sympathy for the plight of the Palestinian people.
As a Pakistani citizen, I think that our government should immediately call for a ceasefire and boycott all the products that are supporting the Israeli aggression in Palestine. And I also want to say that the whole world should come out of their houses and protest, because the kids, Palestinian kids, are starving right now, and they are being starved, and they are scared, and they are homeless, and they have nothing to eat and drink, and they are dying. And how can anybody bear that?
The protesting Pakistanis called on the government to cut its ties with the U.S. over what they call the barbaric role in the killing of innocent men, women and children in Gaza.
People here in Pakistan are concerned about the ongoing atrocities committed by Israeli forces in Gaza. They are demanding that the international community enforce an immediate ceasefire by bringing the U.S. and Israel to the International Court of Justice for their war crimes in Gaza. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Syrians have long been accustomed to eagerly welcoming the holy month of Ramadan, brimming with joy and happiness. But this year has brought an unusual sense of sadness as the harsh economic conditions exacerbated by unjustified Western sanctions is casting a shadow over their celebrations. Moreover, their hearts are heavy with sorrow for their brethren in Gaza, who endure the devastating consequences of the ongoing Israeli onslaught.
We are going through a painful situation as people do not have money due to the poor economic conditions. As store owners, we are trying to consider the people's circumstances by reducing prices during Ramadan. However, basic production materials are expensive due to the importing difficulties.
Ramadan is always a special month, as it is a month of worship, patience and blessings, especially in Palestine. However, this year, it is as if Palestinians in Gaza have been fasting for more than 5 months. We pray for them and gain our determination, patience and steadfastness from them, from the brave faces of Gaza's children, the resilience of its resistance fighters, and the patience of its steadfast women.
Ramadan comes this year while the Western world, which claims freedom and humanity, practices double standards with the people of Gaza, who are suffering from hunger, blockade and Israeli crimes. Palestinians are paying the price for demanding their freedom and legitimate rights. Syrians will always stand with them until the final victory over the Zionist regime and the liberation of the occupied lands.
The month of Ramadan comes this year amid the continued unjust Western economic blockade on Syria. We see our people in Gaza suffering from blockade, hunger, killing, destruction, and continuous Zionist aggression without deterrent.
Syrians are a living nation because they have defended resistance, and the Palestinian people are the soul of resistance. We say to the West, you will lose, and the access of resistance from Iran to Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Yemen will prevail. We will break the Caesar Act and all your blockades on Syria and Gaza, and we will all pray in Al-Quds.
Syrian message to their brothers and sisters in Gaza is that no matter how difficult our circumstances may be, your tragedy in Gaza remains even more challenging, and your resilience is an inspiration not only for us, but for all free people around the world.
Syrians welcome Ramadan this year amid hard economic conditions due to unjust Western sanctions and with heavy hearts for their besieged brothers and sisters in Gaza. Yet their commitment to the resistance fuels their faith in eventual victory. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
This is Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Back to Reality. I'm Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be at your service. And there again, we have two very dear guests, Sister Bita and Sister Rehane. Just as the ritual of this program goes, I would like you both to introduce yourself very much briefly. And let's start with Sister Rehane.
Assalamu alaikum to our dear guests. I'm Rehane. I'm 23. My background in English has been in English translation for now. And I'm a mother of one.
Oh my God, that's very nice. And you, Sister Bita?
Yeah, I'm studying medicine and an honor to be here.
Thank you, both of you, for being here. By the way, I wish you luck in your life and in your studies and in whatever you do. Well, yes, introduction is always like a moment that is, you cannot put your life in just one or two sentences,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But just so that everybody knows, what are you doing? So both of you are very dear to us, and yeah, let's just start it this way, that, okay, do you agree to live a long lifetime or no?
I personally would love to, even though some people say they don't. I believe that it's the more chances you have at redemption, the better, even though it may never come, it's still better than nothing. I would like to live a long time to give myself more chances to become a better person.
And nice, I would come back to you, but then you, yeah. Sister Bita, what do you believe, do you love to have a long life?
You know, we have a limited life, but there are so many unlimited things to talk about it. So I prefer to have a lot of things to talk about my life rather than to have an unlimited life.
You mean like you have a condensed,
exactly,
compact of time?
Yeah. I wanted to put it
of time.
In a non-harsh way.
Now, Sister Hannah said that she wants to have more time because she thinks that in this way she's going to be a better person.
But hopefully.
Hopefully. But then what if those chances never happen to us? You know, because us as human beings, we have this wishful thinking that, okay, I would do this, I would do that in a coming future, in an immediate future. And then, you know, how the circle goes. We start wishing, and the thing that happens is that a lot of things would come in the middle of that. Then you're busy with other stuff. And when the night comes, okay, even in today, I was not able to go according to the plans that I had. What about a long lifetime?
I suppose you are correct. However, I think that it's just that hope. It's the hope that, inshallah, tomorrow I will become a better person. I will do the thing that I've always wanted to do, and I will start that ritual that I've been wanting to have in my life incorporated.
But don't you think what you say comes out of attachment to life?
I suppose, but I don't think there's anyone who can say, I mean, maybe some people who are hopeless, but I don't think normal people could say that they're not attached to life. We all want to live, even if we think we don't. At the last chance, if we think that we're going to die, we're going to wish that we could have lived longer.
We could have one more day. One more day at the time of death. This is the thing that would happen to us. But what are the things that would keep us attached to life, that would make us wish to have a long life?
You know, I don't wish it, personally. To be frank, but, you know, there is a lot of things people want to do, specifically new things. You know, you want to explore this world. You want to know new things, new taste, new people.
Yeah, adventures.
And, adventure is a really major factor for people to want to live longer. I want to live longer because I want to see the world. I want to see how communication works, you know. But the thing is, the end point of this wanting to know more about life is that attachment that you mentioned.
Yeah.
You're attached to the things you have, to materialistic things specifically.
Mm-hmm.
The money you have, the home you have, the
all the
car,
things
the,
that you have tried so hard to achieve
tried.
In your life.
You know, this is the achievement, the accomplishment, all you have.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a problem itself, because you are identifying yourself in a circle of materialistic things. I have a car, so my accomplishment is a car, achievement is a car, okay?
Exactly.
So what is your moral achievement? Yeah, mm-hmm. Because it's the way it is, you know?
Yeah, I guess this is just the setting for our discussion.
Yeah.
Just we put it forward this way that, okay, life is something that happens to you. And in this life, you would have too much of attachments, like just the sister mentioned in here. But then there are some other things that would make people don't wish to have a long life. But before we-